You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode 185 of Below the Belt. Happy New Year to everybody, and Happy New Year to my good friend John McDonald. How are you, sir?
Happy New Year, Kel. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, man. Yeah, all good. All good. Very, very good. Had a little break, obviously, Christmas and New Year. I had a lot going on. But we're back, and we missed an awful lot. But before we dive into all of that, how was your Christmas, John? How was it?
Yeah, Christmas was good. Had a nice long break. Pretty chilled. You have a good one?
I booked the extra week off, hence why we're recording today. So what is it? It's the 4th of January at time of recording. I did book the extra week off. Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah, it was nice. You know, it's the usual stuff. It's, you know, it gets built up into this whole thing, Christmas, doesn't it? But really what it's about is good food, good company, and some Christmas movies. What's your favourite Christmas movie?
Home Alone.
Yes.
Can't beat it. Yep. It's a classic.
Yeah. Agreed. Absolutely agreed. That was easy, wasn't it? What's the best Christmas present you ever got?
Oh, probably the original PlayStation when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. Oh, amazing.
Absolute game-changing present. Like, so far ahead of anything else that's come prior to that. Like, I'd owned the assorted Sega consoles. I'd played on friends' N64s, and then this PlayStation drops and it just blows everything out of the water. It had a game called Heart of Darkness, which was fantastic. Loved that game, played it to death. I think that was by far and away my best Christmas present ever. What would be yours?
I feel like we could do a gaming podcast, to be honest. I could sit here and chat to you about, we do it all the time, don't we? When we're having an offline before we start recording the boxing, we'll sit there and talk about retro games. And I've been doing a lot of moving around lately, and yeah, all the retro games are all together at the minute. Best Christmas present, one that always stands out from my childhood, was getting the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase action figure, but his suit wasn't black, his suit was green. And I think it was like a WrestleMania special or something. And I've still got it. I've still got it somewhere to this day. So probably, yeah, probably the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase action figure that I got as a kid. I absolutely love that thing. I've still got it somewhere. Yeah, I'd love to sit here and talk about retro games, to be honest, but we should probably talk about boxing. Ugh. It's 12 minutes past one on Thursday, the 4th of January, at time of recording. This weekend, John, on the 6th, Virgil Ortiz is due to box Frederick Lawson at Super Welter, so he's moving up in weight. We've done this before. Let's do it again. What time and date do you think he's pulling out?
I would say, let's go for sometime after the weigh-in, but before the day of the fight.
That's his usual one, isn't it? He'll weigh in, he'll be fucked at the weight, and then he'll pull out because of, you know, he's feeling horrible or whatever. That, you know, I'm gonna go 9 a.m. British time, so it'll be the early hours of the morning. I think I'm gonna wake up and he's pulled out. Hopefully not. Hopefully he boxes. Do you think, all jokes aside, do you think he does all right at light middle?
Yeah, he's got a big frame. Like, he was massive when he was at light welter. When he was coming through as a prospect, him and Josh Taylor were coming through at the same time, and I thought that was going to be a hell of a fight, but Ortiz has clearly grown through the weights. I think light middle has been one of my favourite weight classes, but despite the fact that Charlo was undisputed there, no one has ever really cemented their status as the number one for long. He had a couple of losses there. Tim Zhu's appearing there now with Spence and Crawford potentially heading there. Like, we could be seeing a big change in the landscape, and it'll be interesting to see how Virgil Ortiz gets on, because I really, really rate him. When he fights, I'm always very impressed. It's just he hasn't fought since the middle of 2022 or something at this stage.
Wow. I was just about to look that up. August of 2022, Michael McKinson. He's fighting a guy, Frederick Lawson, who's been stopped twice in his last five. So if there's an opportunity for him to get back in with a softest touch, this is kind of it, isn't it, really? Yeah, we just, hopefully the extra £7 does him a favour and he stays there. He should not try and go back to world. So that was clearly an issue. There was clearly something. I know he's got other health issues, but really, really cutting weight for a guy of his size and his frame. You know, he needs to stay at the higher weight, really. But we'll see. We'll see. We'll see how he gets on. And our good friend O'Hara Davies is on the undercard as well, isn't he?
He is. And it's an intriguing fight because if this fight had taken place during the pandemic years against Barroso, I'd be like, oh, like, fine. It's a bit of a nothing fight. But now, after Barroso's performance against Rolly Romero, it's actually really interesting. And I think the quote from O'Hara Davies this week sums it up best. He doesn't know if Rolly Romero is really shit or if Barroso's better than he thought he was. He can't work it out. And I think that is fair.
I think Rolly Romero's kind of reputation at the minute is built based on doing semi all right against Tank before getting knocked out. But surviving for five rounds or whatever it was, he seems to be based on that. And he's a pretty good talker, Rolly, as well. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. It is quite interesting because I don't know how good O'Hara Davies is either, because he's beat, you know, he got this opportunity at world level because he beat Lewis Ritson, you know, in a three quarters empty arena up in Sunderland or Newcastle. I think it was Sunderland, wasn't it? Yeah, I don't even know how good O'Hara Davies is. Is he really that much above British level? But I think we're going to see, aren't we? We're going to see how good he is at the weekend, and we'll see how he gets on. But there's been a lot of stuff going on. Let's start with Boxing Day. Inoue against Marlon Tapales. Boxing Day. How did you set yourself up to watch it, John? What was you doing? Turkey sandwiches? How did you set yourself up?
I woke up about 10:30.
Nice.
Made myself a coffee. Grabbed some, I think it was some leftover pigs and blankets. Had them for a breakfast with my coffee. Sat down just in time for the main event. Watched Inoue put on an absolute masterclass. Tapales proved his worth. Like, we're now at the stage where if a fighter does okay in a round against Inoue, we're like, oh, he's having a go. He's doing really well. Like, that is the level that Inoue is operating at, that we now give massive credit for them having a bit of a go and not just retreating and going in the back foot. But Tapales did give it an effort, and it was nice having boxing on Boxing Day. What was your setup?
Yeah, it was pretty similar. I actually got up pretty early. I ended up watching some of the undercard as well. It was really good watch. What did I eat? I think I had egg and bacon. I've been eating a lot of egg and bacon over Christmas in some sort of bread. I did that and sat there and watched it. And it was, Yeah, you're right. We're giving guys like Topalez loads of credit because he, you know, because he had a go. He's a unified world champion. He's supposed to have a go. Like, that's what he's supposed to do. He's there to win the Undisputed Championship. They're two belts each. He's supposed to have a go. But he did have a go, bless him. He did have a really good go at it. And he was landing some nice left hands to the body in particular. And Inoue, what I kind of noticed was when he dropped, when did he drop to Palace? That was, when was that? It was quite early on. And what he was doing at that point was he was working the body quite a lot, Inoue. And then after that, he stopped. He stopped working the body and he started headhunting after that. And I think that's what let to Palace back into the fight. Did you notice that?
Yeah, and he's been guilty of this in the past. Sometimes he does go headhunting rather than leaning on that beautiful left hook to the body that he's got, which is one of my favourite punches in boxing. Inoue's left hook to the body is a killer punch. It's what buckled Jamie McDonnell, first of all. Like, it's a great, great shot, but he did go headhunting. I don't know, was he trying to get something spectacular, a highlight reel knockout? Or if he felt that he was too open when he was throwing to the body, because Topalez has got good hand speed, he's got good timing, he can throw from unorthodox angles, and he's got every punch in the book. Like, he's a really technically skilled fighter, so I'm not sure what led to that change, but he did go a bit headhunting, and it is probably what resulted in it going 10 rounds.
I think as well, with a southpaw, they always say, when you know, if you're an orthodox fighter boxing a southpaw, the straight right hand is your weapon of choice, isn't it? It's what tends to find the mark. And actually, we saw that he started to use that more and more as the fight won, and that was actually the shot that ended the fight in the end, wasn't it? It was a really hard right hand down the pipe, which dropped to Palace. And but no, I liked Palace. He had a good go at it. You know, he tried, but he was just in with a guy just far too good for him. It seems like he's going to stay at Super Bantam now, John, Inoue.
Yeah, it appears so. I think that there's this interesting angle with Luis Neri, who's WBC's mandatory challenger, because he's persona non grata in Japan for his two fights with Yamanaka. Because in the first fight, he stops Yamanaka in, I think, about four rounds and tests positive for clenbuterol. The WBC, being the WBC, dealing with a Mexican, decided it was contaminated beef. So they had a rematch for the vacant title at bantamweight. And Neri comes in weighing just under the super bantamweight limit, so he can't win the title, and he blasts Yamanaka out of there, sends Yamanaka, a long reigning champion, into retirement, and he received what was presumed to be a lifetime ban from the Japanese Boxing Council.
Oh dear. So if they fight, it might have to be in the States then, John, do you think?
It might have to be in the States, but if there was ever a fight that the JBC would overrule their decision for, it's this one, to let Neri come back to Japan and have Inoue knock lumps out of him.
Yeah, that's it. I suppose they'd want some sort of justice for, for their guy over there. So maybe. I was just having a look. He actually, Luis Neri suspended in California. Why was that? Was it a drugs issue? Was that why?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm wondering, how long was the suspension? Because they sometimes give suspensions in some of these state athletic commissions if they've been in hard fights, and his fight with Hovhannissian was brutal.
It might have just been... I know what you're saying. Sometimes when they have a tough fight, it wasn't after a particularly tough fight. It just says Luis Neri fought with an active suspension in California. But it wouldn't have been for the clenbuterol, would it? It wouldn't have been because of that. Anyway, we'll find out.
No.
We'll never know. We'll find out at some point. Do you think that's going to be next then, the WBC mandatory? Are they next in line?
They're talking about that fight in May. And given Inui's two fight a year schedule at the minute, I would presume that is going to be next. Mm.
Yeah, and it feels like he's going to stay there for the year, doesn't it? At least for a year, because I think he said something on the lines of he still feels like he's growing into the weight. He's not quite fully at the weight yet. He's still getting there. So we expect him to stay there for at least 2024, if not 2025.
I'm not sure, because Top Rank have got a lot of options for Inoue up at featherweight, because they've got Luis Alberto Lopez, they've got Espinoza and Rubezi Ramirez, whoever's got the title at the end of that, and they recently signed Kolmatov, who's fighting Ray Ford for the WBA belt that used to be in possession of Lee Wood. So they could have three of the champions there. And given Inui's fondness for belt collecting, I could see him getting involved there, because Top Rank have got everything in-house and ready to go for him. So I think we see him there in 2025. If that's not his last fight of the year, in 2024.
Yeah, I guess, you know, he said something on the lines of, well, he's not too really bothered about belts. That's rubbish. Absolute rubbish. you know, there was better fights for him at Super Bantam than Marlon Tapales, wasn't there? But, you know, he wanted the belts. He wanted to go undisputed, and so he should. Absolutely fair play to him. Yeah, I think you're right. I think he'll go Luis Nery, maybe Casemiro. That fight's been spoken about forever, although Casemiro's 34 now, and you can imagine the next loss will be the last one. He's just coming off a draw. So if he can get into a mandatory position, I think it's going to be mandatories that's going to kind of dictate it. And we'll see. We'll see. We'll see what will happen with Inoue. But it was great fun. I love him so much. I love watching Inoue. He's just such a fantastic fighter. Everything he does is fluid. Even his defense is really underrated as well. He's fantastic. A lot of discussion online, actually. I'm going to put you on the spot. You know I like to do this. About who's going to be the... We actually spoke about this last time out. Who's going to be the fighter of the year, Terence Crawford or Inoue? Now the year's out, where are we with that?
It's not difficult for me. It's Inoue, because Crawford had one very good win. Inoue had two. And again, it's not unheard of for somebody to get Fighter of the Year fighting only once. Like, either Tyson Fury or Teofimo Lopez got it in 2020 for Wilder 2 or Lomachenko. I think with The Ring, they shared the title that year. In the 80s, Marvin Hagler won it for stopping Tommy Hearns in the war. But for me, the COVID year, there's mitigation. And beating Errol Spence is not the same as beating Hitman Hearns in one of the most iconic fights of all time. The justification for people picking Crawford is that Spence was a top five pound for pound guy. And for me, I always felt that he was a bit overrated. There was absolutely nothing wrong with his resume. Like, he did pretty well, but to be a guy who'd fought at one weight and his wins being Kell Brook, a lightweight Mikey Garcia, and the PBC welterweights, it just wasn't enough for that lofty ranking. Like, as far as I'm concerned, Stephen Fulton's trio of wins prior to facing Inoue of Leo, Figueroa, and Roman matches favourably with any three consecutive wins of Errol Spence. I don't think that there was a great deal of difference between Fulton and Spence in terms of the quality of that win. It's Western bias. Like, The Ring has only ever had one Asian win Fighter of the Year. Manny Pacquiao has won it three times, but only him for as long as they've been running the event. In their Fight of the Year, only five fights have ever involved Asian fighters. Right. One of those was Inoue against Donair 1, but there's a massive Western bias. Most of these awards go to Americans or Europeans. And for me this year, I think a lot of people are going to do that. They're going to give it to Terence Crawford, but realistically, It's Inoue quite clearly for me. Do you agree, or do you think I'm talking rubbish?
No, I absolutely agree. Where it was surprised me? It was Boxing News' awards. I haven't seen Rings. Did Ring give it to Crawford as well?
They haven't announced yet, but I imagine they'll give it to Crawford.
I saw that Boxing News gave it to Crawford, and I might get in some trouble for this, but I just thought it just felt a bit clickbaity. It just felt a bit like this is, you're right, to me it's so obvious. It's Inoue. He's gone undisputed twice in 377 days. Of course it's Inoue. Like, it's not difficult. And Crawford was a favourite in the fight with Spence. A narrow one, but still a favourite. And the wins you're talking about with, you know, with Tyson Fury and with Teofimo Lopez. Teofimo Lopez, you know, beating Lomachenko, no one expected that. It was such a big win and such a fantastic performance. And the same with Fury, you know, COVID obviously was a factor, but such a fantastic performance that you can see why they got it. And perhaps it just wasn't the standout candidates. In this instance, there is a standout candidate outside of Crawford, and it's Inoue, and the achievements back it up, the performances back it up. And it just felt, seeing people pick Crawford, it's either, like you say, you know, American Western bias, or it's, oh, let's drive some conversation, you know, when actually it's a, to use the term, it's a layup, it's easy, it's Inoue. He should be the fighter of the year because of what he's done, the performances, the wins, the belts, the achievements. It's easy for me, but yeah, I take your point.
Yeah, I agree, and I think with Boxing News, it's also possible that Boxing News had a big presence at Spence Crawford, both on the video and editorial side. It's possible that they got a little bit swept up and that I was there. Right. Like, it felt like a big event. It felt like the defining moment of the year because they were there throughout all of fight week. It's sometimes easy to have that bias. Like, if you talk about the greatest games of football you've ever watched, chances are you pick one that you were actually in the stadium for.
Yeah. It's a fair point because you get caught up more in the feeling of being there and the event itself. And if you wasn't at both the new A fights, but you was at Spence. And Spence, you know, in terms of the event of the year, yes, Crawford Spence, even performance, actually. Crawford's performance was that good. In terms of a one-off fight, you could argue, but I would caveat that with Spence was so poor. He looked completely shot. And the fact that when a rematch hasn't been announced yet, enough, it's definitely quiet around Spence, that says everything to me. It says absolutely everything to me that, that, you know, I don't know if Crawford's trying to fight him again at welterweight, which I think is completely out of order. But, you know, I think it says it all, really, in terms of that performance. Spence looked horrible. He's had Crawford was great and boxed great, but it was another one-sided performance for Crawford. And I suppose with great fighters, that's always that sometimes is the case, is that they'll make the toughest fights look easy. But we won't know how good that win is until Spence boxes again. That's when Crawford will really get the credit that he deserves. But yeah, in terms of performance of the year, I think Crawford, yeah. But overall, fighter of the year for me is Nao Inoue. Okay, we've got a lot to cover on the Saudi show, so we should probably jump onto the Saudi show. Oof.
Let's go for it.
All right, I'm going to try and see what order to do this in. I'll work from the bottom. This made me laugh out. I actually missed Frank Sanchez and Junior Fai. I missed that because I think I was watching the Spurs game. How was that? Did you watch that fight?
I did, and it was Frank Sanchez being Frank Sanchez. He's incredibly patient to the point of it being a frustrating watch. He was allowing Junior Fa to be in the fight far more than he had to be. Bear in mind that it was only two fights previous that Junior Fa got chinned by Lucas Brown in a round. But Frank Sanchez isn't the sort of fighter who's just going to come bombing forwards. He's going to patiently wait for his opening. And when he found it, he took it, got the nice stoppage win in the end, which was enough to lift the performance. If that had gone the distance, his stock would have diminished. It wasn't a performance that was going to build a lot of buzz or hype, but in the end he got there, and I still think he's a threat to some of the bigger names because he is accurate, he is patient, he doesn't give you a lot of openings. Sometimes he does carry people more than he should, in the same way that Tank can be guilty of that because he's patient and waiting for that one punch. Fights can look more competitive than they should be because they're waiting for that one big moment, and I feel that Frank Sanchez does the same sometimes.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I suppose Junior Fa was just made to order for him, wasn't it? It was a couple of knockdowns, three knockdowns in the end, and then got him out there by the seventh. What do you think they do with Sanchez next?
I think that he'll be involved in this big heavyweight merry-go-round. I don't know if they give him Caballel next, if they give him Bacoli next, Parker next. It's hard to predict what the Saudis see as their priority for who to match with each other going forwards, but I think he's going to be involved in the people that are on this Saudi conveyor belt. What do you think?
Yeah, looking at it, there's obviously, I remember you saying a few pods ago about Joe Joyce, and Joe Joyce needing a kind of a, he's on a big guarantee with Frank Warren, and Saudi is kind of Frank's way out of that, isn't it? Saudi will pay the money to get to make sure that Joe Joyce gets his minimum. Maybe they feed him to Frank Sanchez. Maybe that's Joe Joyce's kind of cash out fight. Maybe that's his rebirth fight. Maybe he comes back. Not sure there. But you would think with this heavyweight merry-go-round, like you were saying, that Joe Joyce is going to find a way in there, just because he has a contract with Frank and he's not going to sell a ticket over here. So you'd think Saudi's the way back in for him. But we'll see.
I think Joe Joyce has got his path laid out. I am expecting to see Dubois Joyce 2 in Saudi at some point this year. I think given that Dubois came through the Big Baby Miller test, which is the Tesco value version of Joe Joyce. Massive, great, big lump coming forward, applying pressure to you, etc., etc. I think that that was gauging if it was the time to pull the trigger on that rematch and get the result that Queensbury probably wanted first time round.
It was a good... Let's move on to Dubois. It was a good... I actually made that comparison myself on the night, you know. I said, he's just like Joe Joyce. He comes forward, he takes a lot of shots, but he's got a good chin. But he's slow. Although he had quicker hands than Dubois, actually, Miller. So you expect it... You think that'll be in Saudi, and you think, what, sometime in the spring, maybe? Joyce and Dubois too?
Yeah, it's going to happen. Like, if it's on the undercard of the Undisputed fight, I think it comes a bit too soon, but it could be on the undercard of whatever they decide to do with Anthony Joshua next.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. That does make sense. Yeah, we'll see. What did you think of Dubois Miller? Did you enjoy it?
It was a freak show of a fight, and I'm all here for it. It was interesting. It had ebbing and flowing momentum. There were times where it looked like Dubois was going to buckle under the pressure. There was times where it looked as if Big Baby Miller was going to have a cardiac arrest. You know, it was fantastic.
I loved it. I love Dubois. Like, he's just this flawed genius, if you like. You don't want to hear him speak. You don't want to hear him give a lecture on anything. Although when he does speak, it does tend to be hilarious when he's asked to speak more than a few words. But yeah, you've got this gobby New York guy, Miller, and Dubois, and Miller was well overweight, but he actually in the early middle rounds, I say 3, 4, and 5, he had the hand speed was troubling Dubois quite a bit, and the commentary were. They got into this kind of... they started to get into this rhythm of talking about, oh, Dubois in trouble. And it didn't really look like that because Miller just doesn't have the power. And once Dubois started to turn around, you could see the stoppage come in. It was only set for 10 rounds. And I was out of my seat when Dubois got the stoppage at the end because it just felt like I wanted Dubois to win just because I don't particularly like Miller. And was delighted for him. And you could see how happy he was as well, couldn't you, John?
Yeah, and he needed that. I thought Don Charles did a tremendous job in the corner of guiding him through that fight, keeping his spirits up, convincing him that it was working, to stick with it. And then I thought the DJ in Saudi deserved a pay rise for, after the stoppage happened, he played Daddy Cool in reference to Dubois' one-liner that was clearly pre-rehearsed at the final press conference, where he said that Miller might be the big baby, but he was going to be his daddy, and then was very proud of himself and had the big grin on his face that he managed to say it without stumbling over his words. And then for the DJ to then play Daddy Cool at the end, nice touch. I liked it. It was a feel-good fight. It's nice seeing Big Baby Miller getting stopped. And just while we're here, actually, on Big Baby Miller, did you hear the news yesterday that he's been arrested?
Yes, I did. It was a carjacking?
It was a carjacking. So we hear all about the massive money that Saudi are paying, life-changing money. Well, Big Baby Miller's carjacking and Martin Bacoli's doing a GoFundMe.
Fair point. It seems perhaps all the money's going to the main event. It feels like one of those Anthony Crawler Matrim cards back in the day where they had to make sure Anthony Crawler cleared six figures so everybody else is on peanuts. It feels like that. Yeah, it's a fair point, actually. You think, you know, Hergovic and Sanchez would all, you know, make good money, but I guess they're playing the long game, you know. They're you know, thinking, oh, I'll take the short money now and make the big money later on if I win. But yeah, I did think that myself, actually. He's just gone to Saudi, he's boxed in Saudi. You think he'd have cleared good money, and there he is, he's come back and, you know, innocent till proven guilty and all that shit, but, you know, he's somehow involved in a carjacking, allegedly. So, yeah, real shame.
Well, I doubt it's a case of mistaken identity. No. How many 300-pound guys are walking about?
Yeah, that's true. He's a big lump.
He's got a distinctive look. He's hard to mistake.
Yeah. He's going to have some trouble. He's going to need Johnny Cochran. He's going to need Johnny Cochran Jr. to come out and try and say, keep him out of prison. Yeah, we'll see. We shall see. But yeah, Dubar Joyce, I'm up for that. Who would you pick, Dubar Joyce?
Still Joyce.
Wow. So do you think... Because I think his chin's gone.
I don't think his chin's gone. I think he was facing the guy that was all wrong for him, who had massive power.
Right. Yeah. It's a fair... Yeah,
I don't think that his chin is gone. I think if Zhang hits anyone clean, the same result will happen. Zhang struggles with hand speed. Like, he almost lost to Jerry Forrest. Smaller guys with speed give them fits. Like, Michael Hunter would probably beat Zhang. But I think Joyce would walk through Hunter. I think Joyce has still got a lot to offer to the heavyweight division. And given that Dubois had some real issues with Miller until Miller really started to tire in the second half of the fight, Joyce doesn't tire. Joyce doesn't slow down. I don't know if Dubois has got an answer to that Joyce jab. I don't think he's done yet, but again, no one will know until we see him in another big fight. Is his punch resistance gone, or was Zhang all wrong for him? And it's interesting, we're in either camp here, and one of us will get to gloat at some point this year.
I do. I think his chin's gone. I think he's just eaten too many shots, be it in sparring or in fights, and I think it's chipped. I think it's chipped away at it, and I don't think he... What it was, it wasn't the second fight that made me think it was the first fight. And it was seeing him wobbly legs all over the place. And it's like, that's not you. That's not... There's something wrong here. And there was a lot of focus on the swelling around his eye and the eye injury. And that was kind of his get out. But the worrying thing for me was him being on wobbly legs in the second round. I was like, there's an issue here. Maybe the chin's gone, the punch resistance is gone. But you're right, we'll see. Hopefully they'll make it, and one of us will be right and one of us will be wrong. But I completely get your point. Joyce's jab was imperious in that first Dubois fight, and if he gets that going again in the second fight, I think you're right, he'll win again. But I'm going to go with Dubois for now. I tell you what, probably my favourite fight of the night was Caballero Makhmudov. Makhmudov gives massive David Price energy. Massive. I think it's because he looks like him. I was saying to my brother, I was watching it with him. I was watching my brother and I said, he's giving me David Price energy. And then he goes and does a kind of a soft, well, not a soft, quick job. He gets stopped to the body. When was the last time you saw a heavyweight stopped to the body, John?
Not at any sort of level. Like, it's... You do occasionally see it with prospects coming up, but not in a fight of this magnitude. But Caballero boxed really well. And Caballero's always had something like that in his locker. He boxed rings around Derek Chisora in Monaco years ago, and Makhmudov, there were warning signs. Like, he didn't look great against Takam and Vak back in 2022. There were concerns there. I still thought he would just be a bit too big for Kabayel. I thought he would beat Kabayel by decision. I thought Kabayel would be on the back foot, but Kabayel realised he had the edge in hand speed and that this guy just did not like getting hit back. Makhmudov is a flat track bully. And again, that's fine. Like, there'll be plenty of interesting fights that you can make with a guy like that, but not at the top level. I think his days as a serious heavyweight prospect are now over.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it did. It just smacked off the second Tony Thompson fight with David Price. It was just he just panicked. As soon as he started getting hit back, he panicked and he gassed. And he got stopped to the body. And that's a really, really bad stoppage. And it's going to be really difficult for him to get over. I think he's just going to be a guy that knocks over puddings and then gets beat every time he gets in with someone half decent. And that's okay. You know, if he makes a good living out of it, then fair play to him. But I was happy for Kabayel. I don't know why. I think just because everybody expected Makhmudov to win. And yeah, I like the way he went about it. Going to the body, aggressive, took some shots as well. Yeah, I was really pleased for him. But actually, probably the moment of the night that made me laugh the most was Filip Hrgović hitting Mark Domori and Mark Domori turning his back.
He did it more than once. He didn't want to be there. He wanted to take his paycheck and get back to a beach in Australia.
Oh, it just made me laugh. I was watching it with my little nephew, and he didn't understand why that was so funny, but it just was. He just turned his back. He was just like, nope, no thank you. The ref should have waved it off then, really. He was done at that point. But he ended up letting him go back in and get beaten up a little bit more. He just didn't want to. Yeah, like you said, he was there to make a couple of quid. Whoever his agent is, fair play to him for getting him the payday. But Hrgović, he's IBF number one. It doesn't sound like he's going to fight Joshua next, does it?
It's difficult to see what's going to happen here. It depends when the titles fall vacant. The IBF are pretty strict on calling their mandatories. And we haven't had an IBF mandatory in a while, which I think means that probably the winner of Undisputed will be called to face Hrgović quite quickly. Probably ahead of a rematch, and that belt will likely get dropped. So it depends what they decide to do with Joshua. Joshua beating Otto Wallin will result in him being the number two in the IBF ratings.
Right.
Because Wallin held that position. So if the belt becomes vacant, there's the option of a vacant title there for Joshua Hrgović, because realistically, if Wilder is currently off the table, your two options for Joshua are Hrgović for the IBF belt or Joseph Parker. As far as I see it, I can't really see a third viable option at the minute. Do you think that's fair?
It is fair, what you kind of missed is how strongly Eddie Hearn is trying to make the Francis Ngannou fight.
he is talking
about that fight with a lot of passion, because I think he's trying to keep Joshua in safe-ish fights to get him a world title fight against Fury or Usyk again. He wants Fury. He wants it to be Fury. I think they know they can't beat Usyk. They know Usyk's just too good. He's just too good for Joshua. They want it to be Fury. They want the Fury fight. They probably think Fury's on the way out, and you know, Fury's incredibly quiet at the minute, considering he's boxing in a month. You know, he's not talking about sausages and little middleweights and all of that. He's very quiet at the minute. And I think they probably think Fury's ready. He's ready to go. And they want that Fury fight. It's the bigger money fight. And they probably see it as the more winnable fight. But in the meantime, they want to keep Joshua safe. And so I think they probably think they'll beat Hrgović. and but they seem to be really talking about Francis Ngannou because it's easy. I think they look at it as an easy fight, and it's Parker. I think he'd beat Parker. It's hard to see what we got out of Parker out of that Wilder fight. It was so strange. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure really, but I think they might go for Ngannou if they can. If not, I suppose it will have to be Parker. We're talking about heavyweights. We'll talk about all the cruisers and that in a minute. What did you make of the Deontay Wilder and Joseph Parker fight? It was strange, wasn't it?
It was and it wasn't, because we've seen this before with Deontay Wilder. He didn't win a round of either of the Luis Ortiz fights, except the one where he got the knockout. And against Hellenius, in his only fight since the conclusion of the Fury trilogy, he scored the knockout by being on the back foot, moving into a corner. This is obviously the way that they've been trying to do the evolution of Deontay Wilder with Malik Scott, is to try and have him on the back foot, walking people onto shots. And the problems that he was having are things that we've seen before. The only difference was he didn't find the right hand to change it. Like, Spilka gave him all sorts of problems by applying pressure, using lateral movement, changing his level up and down on the way in, backing him up against the ropes. Like, none of this was unusual for Deontay Wilder. What was unusual was that the right hand never followed through, as far as I'm concerned. Do you think being too overly simplistic with that?
No, I think you're right. It felt like it had strong Luis Ortiz energy about it. I felt the second fight. The first fight was more open and more aggressive, and he just never... Wilder just... No, first of all, big credit to Joseph Parker and Andy Lee, actually, for coming up with a game plan to be aggressive, to smother him, to make him uncomfortable. It worked. They'd obviously watched a lot of tape on Wilder and thought, right, he wants to walk you onto something. You've just got to get in his face, basically, and make him really uncomfortable. And that's what they did. And Wilder, yeah, you're right. He was just trying to find, like, when he boxed his last fight, I've forgotten the guy's name now.
Hellenius.
Yeah, that was it, Hellenius. He just walked him onto a shot, didn't he? Just walked him onto a right hand, and that was that. Same with Luis Ortiz. He waited for Ortiz to tire, and he found a shot. And Joseph Parker didn't tire, and Joseph Parker didn't eat anything clean. But he just, while we've seen that before, Wilder looked particularly passive. And after the fight was quite, it was really interesting how Wilder was after the fight. He's been doing mushrooms, hasn't he, basically? He's been doing mushrooms, and he's a changed man. I can't say what they're called. You might be able to say the word, but I can't. I've not said the word before. I'm not confident saying it. But he's been doing mushrooms, and now he's a changed man. And he didn't seem bothered. He just didn't seem bothered, did he, John, that he'd lost?
Yeah, but he also was raising his hand and believes that he won on the judges' scorecards, which shows me there's a bit of the old Deontay Wilder in there. Because Deontay Wilder never feels that he's been beaten. Mm. There's always a reason why it went wrong. Like, his suit was too heavy. His water bottle got spiked. Tyson Fury had messed with his gloves. Like, there's always a reason. And the fact that he is denying a clear-cut loss was a loss shows me that there's still enough of the old Deontay Wilder in there. I think that he will still be able to get wins against a lot of top guys. The problem is, Deontay Wilder didn't face the best competition when he was making his world title defences. So we don't know, is this him deteriorating, or if Joseph Parker was always the wrong style of fighter, because he never faced someone like that who could be compact, coming forward, good hand speed, good footwork, was agile. That wasn't the sort of guys that Deontay Wilder faced. They tended to be a bit slower, a bit stiffer, a bit more upright. You know, your Dominic Brazils, etc., etc. And when he did face guys who did try and put some pressure on him, like Eric Molina, he had his problems. But he usually found the answer. There was no answer here. And again, I'm not convinced he's finished. A bit like Joyce, I don't know if Joseph Parker was just a bad style matchup. Like, give me Arslan Beck, Makhmudov, and Deontay Wilder, two monstrous punchers, whoever lands first wins, whoever misses is flat on their back. Like, give me that shootout. I still think that there's interesting fights out there for Deontay Wilder.
Yeah, yeah, and I think as long as there's a payday for him, maybe he will box again. Makhmudov, you can book it for six rounds. It's not going to go any more than six. Actually, here's another one. And it was spoken about before, but it's got another twist on it now. Wilder Joyce. They both need it.
Robert. Yep.
You know.
Give it to
me. Yeah, I'd watch that. I'd watch Wilder Joyce. I'd still watch Wilder in boxing matches because he still has that right hand. I still believe he has it.
But it's really interesting now because that fight was always billed as the unstoppable force against the immovable object. But we've seen that Wilder isn't always going to land the right hand and Joyce can be stopped.
That's why I like it. They are who they are as fighters, but it's got a different twist on it now. They're different fighters. They're almost different fighters now. So I can go with that. Maybe give Dubois somebody else. I think Dubois got to fight people kind of like Miller, people that are come forward. I don't think you want to put him in there with boxers. Dubois Zhang. I want to see Zhang get a crack at this Saudi money as well. Where do you think Zhang kind of fits into all of this?
He is going to fit in the picture at some point because of that WBO interim title that he currently holds. He is the WBO mandatory, but the WBO are probably going to be the most compliant with whatever Frank Warren wants.
Yeah.
So he might be hovering about. They're going to have to feature him at some point because he is going to be involved in the title picture at some stage. They're going to have to get him in here, but it's trying to find any of the top guys who want anything to do with Zhang on the back of the two Joyce victories. I think a lot of the top guys are going to hope that they can age him out, just bide their time and hope for him to get older and slower, and that'll be enough.
What we were talking about fights for Joshua. Zhang's not an option, is he, for Joshua?
Not at the minute. Not with the rebuild. Like, I'm sort of thinking that although Ngannou makes sense, what could possibly make more sense is if the IBF call Hrgović immediately after the Undisputed fight. If Joshua beats Hrgović, if they're confident that, you know, he's back, he's reborn, then you stick him in with Hrgović, you get the IBF belt on him, you have him fight Ngannou shortly after the rematch between Usyk and Fury as a world champion, give Ngannou his world title fight, and then go and fight the winner of Undisputed on the back of reclaiming a world title belt. So nice, I did it thrice, etc., etc. Beating Ngannou, his value increases exponentially. And at the end of the day, Eddie Hearn is a businessman, and that is probably the route that makes the most money. I think Zhang is too high risk. I think Zhang was being entertained as a fight in the bird's nest as Anthony Joshua's retirement payday if there was nothing else on the horizon. I think now that they've got good options for him again, I don't think we'll see Zhang entering the fray.
No, he's massive, a southpaw and a puncher. And he's not going to sell a fight either. In China, he's not going to really sell a fight. So there's not a lot of reward for him. But like you said, politically, he has to get in because he's got that interim title. And he's just coming off two massive wins. And he pushed Hrgović very, very close, arguably won that fight. So he has to find a way in at some point. There's going to be, you know, he's going to become like a boogeyman. He's going to become like the Paul Williams of the heavyweight division. Nobody wants to fight him. And
I've got a Zhang idea. Yeah, how do you solve a problem like Zhang? So realistically, none of the top guys want to fight him. But he, because of his status with the WBO, he's got to feature. He's previously struggled with small, fast guys like Jerry Forrest, who he drew with. So what about sticking him in with Cabell, whose footwork will give him fits, whose hand speed will give him fits, who can get in and out and avoid the big, ponderous left hand, who might be able to get past the jab? And then if you've got that WBO interim status on Cabell, there'll be people who would be more than willing to fight Cabell.
Dubois. You can see Dubois getting an interim belt. The guy's already been a regular. I liked that they announced Dubois as a former world champion. That made me smile. That did make me smile when he was announced as a former world champion. I don't know if it was Michael Buffer or David Diamante. I can't remember who the MC was. But yeah, they said a former WBA world champion. I was like, go on, Dan. Go on. We know it's not true, but you have your fun, mate.
Was it Thomas Tiber at that stage?
Might have been. That sounds right. Yeah. That sounds right. But yeah, they announced him as a former world champion, which made me smile. Yeah, that makes sense. Zhang Cabell keeps him busy, keeps him on the Saudi card. Two good fighters coming off wins. Yeah, big wins. It makes sense. I like it. I like it. Let's skim through these other... Let's skim through these other fights now. Opetaia, blink. It was a blink and you missed it job, wasn't it? Him against Zorro.
Yeah, poor Zorro, like, should not have been in the ring. I didn't like that Opetaia dropped his belt to engage in this two-fight deal. I don't like that the Saudis want to make Opetaia bivol at some sort of catch weight. But it does lean into my bold prediction on our last podcast where I said that the Saudis are going to make belts irrelevant starting in 2024. Yeah. If we end up with Bivol, Opetaia, a catch weight, that's the beginning of the end of belts.
Yeah, it becomes about fights, not belts then.
Yep.
Yeah, and it almost does away with weight classes as well. You could argue that point as well. It's like, I'll sod weight classes. You know, forget the traditional weight classes. We'll start making our own. Maybe Bridger weight makes a comeback. Maybe they call it His Excellency weight and then they just fight whatever they like. I don't know. Maybe they do away with Bridgerweight. The WBC can always be bought. If they need to name a weight division after His Excellency, then I'm sure the WBC will be more than happy to do so. Yeah, I think it was literally one of those Opetaia Zorro. It shouldn't have happened. He's had to give up his world title in order to fight someone well beneath his level. Him and Bivol, yeah, I get it. The better be a fight... Bob Arum didn't seem interested in making that Bivol better be here because they're both Russian and he just didn't want to touch it. Perhaps. I didn't know about that. Opetaia Bivol, but who would you fancy in that one?
Opetaia. Unless the weight was set at something like 180, because Opetaia is big. If the weight favours him in any sort of way, I think Opetaia is just too big for Bivol. Like, it's an oversimplification, but a good big man beats a good little man most of the time.
Yeah, I'd agree. Opetaia is very good. We've not really got to see him on these shores how good he is because he's fighting British level guys, really. But Bivol was getting a bit of criticism on the commentary. I don't know if you heard that on the DAZN commentary in his performance against Lyndon Arthur. I don't think he could have done much more to get Arthur out of there. He just doesn't hit hard enough. I don't think it's much more to it than that, but they were being quite critical of him. Did you notice that?
Yeah, they were being critical of him, and it's interesting because I think it's something that has been forgotten. But you see, for the people who watched Bivol on the way up on Box Nation, he was being billed as a bit of a light heavyweight Golovkin because he was stopping everybody. On the way up, he was devastating. Very few people were standing up to what he was delivering. And it could be argued that once he stepped up to world class, he doesn't hit quite as hard. In the same way that Usyk was stopping everybody on the way up in the cruiserweight division, but when he got to world class, the stoppages didn't come as frequently. But I think there's also an issue with Bivol at world class level, is he just doesn't commit enough. There was never a third phase with his attacks against Lyndon Arthur. I think he could have got him out of there, but they had to be in sixes and sevens, not in threes and fours. He's a very cautious, very calculated fighter who won't leave that opportunity. If he'd gambled a bit more, I think Lyndon Arthur was there for the taking.
Yeah, I thought they were being harsh, but I take your point. I think there wasn't... Maybe he's been dropped in sparring a few times and he's become extra cautious because of that. He just... I know what you're saying. He doesn't just think, you know what, don't worry about what's coming back. Not like, the actual Golovkin, who would just take the shots and then just keep coming forward. Yeah. He's not that guy. He won't take the shots. He'll step off and then come back in and land three or four. I take your point. Maybe he has to go to Cruiser to get another money fight, because the Beterbiev fight or the Callum Smith fight, you never know. Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to happen. Maybe the Callum Smith wins. That you'd think that would get made, actually. I take your point. That is actually the whole card, isn't it? Yes, it is.
I think we've got through everything.
Well done. Good job, John. So we've done Fighter of the Year. What's one thing? It can be a boxing match itself, or it can be just a thing to happen. What would you like to see happen in 2024?
I'll go with something a little bit random, a little bit left field. And I'll say that one thing I want to happen is for more of a spotlight to be put on minimum weight, which is really quite hot at the minute. And the best way to do that is to get one of the Shigeoka brothers to fight Oscar Collazo. It's a fight between unbeaten guys. They can dig, and I think it would really put some eyes onto minimum weight in the way that the Superfly series on HBO put eyes onto Superfly. And I think it would be good for the sport if people realise that these lower weight classes can actually produce some pretty big fights.
It's a good shout, actually. I think, actually, to put a twist on that, why not the Sauerlands invest in a super series at minimum weight, to put a bit more. It's not going to cost the earth, going to cost the earth to do it. They're not on massive money, and if you can get some Middle Eastern money involved, or Vegas, have Vegas do it, to rebuild Vegas back up again, because they've got to be worried. Maybe something like that, because we've not seen it, haven't we? There was talk about them doing it, I think it was at Super Feather in the women's division, and then they just didn't bother. They just, for whatever reason, they decided to get into Misfits boxing instead. I like it. I think that's good. I've put a slight twist on what you've said, but yeah, I think...
No, I like it. You've made it better, because there's other good fighters like Alex Winwood from Australia coming through, it's a time where that division could really be quite hot if you could get some eyes on it.
Yeah, and actually looking at the BoxRec rankings, there's a lot of guys there that haven't had many fights. 6-0, 6-2-1, 8-0, 8-0. Why not get these guys into a tournament where they can make a few quid and make a name for themselves? Even if you stuck a big fight on the top of the card, a heavyweight fight or a big fight at the top of it. But you have these guys, you have these guys in, underneath. And because that's what worked for Superfly, wasn't it? That's what got Chocolatito on the map, into the mainstream, was fighting on the Golovkin undercards. People, boxing hardcores knew who Chocolatito was, but, perhaps the mainstream didn't. And maybe that's a way of doing it, is having a star as the headline, but having these guys underneath and giving them the TV time that, that they deserve.
They did it with Ricardo Lopez in the 90s.
Yes.
The Mexican minimum weight champion, who was always on big HBO pay-per-view cards.
Was that the guy that was 51-0?
No, I think that's the Thai guy. He had a lovely record in the end, Ricardo Lopez. He only had one draw against Alvarez, I think. He was undefeated, but it wasn't quite as high as 50-0.
Nah, yeah, it was
I think you're thinking of
a different Ricardo Lopez.
He was 51-0-1. He was minimum weight.
Yeah. That's the one. He was 51. I didn't realize it was quite as high as 50. I thought he was just under that. But yeah, that is. That's the one.
That's the one. That's the guy.
So what would you do? What would be your one big thing?
I'm gonna be a hater. Conor Benn to get knocked out.
It would be popular.
It would be popular. Yeah, I'd love to see Conor Benn get stopped in a fight. It would just the guy. Yeah, the way that whole drugs thing was handled, not just by him but by everyone at Matchroom, it would only be justice if he lost the fight and lost it emphatically. I don't want to see him get hurt or anything, but to see him get stopped, possibly to the body, that would make me quite happy for the year.
It would be even better if it's by someone like Peter Dobson, who he's fighting next, someone who's pretty unheralded. Yeah. Not many people have heard of him.
Oh yeah, I don't want him making anyone $50,000 for it. Like it's he doesn't get $5 million to get stopped. He gets $50,000 and he gets taxed a lot of it as well. Yeah. I woke up this morning drunk a tall glass of Haterade this morning. Yeah, that would be mine. Conor Benn, lose a fight. Yeah, just go away. Anyway, that'll do. Thank you so much, John. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time, and I will talk to you soon. Sports Social Podcast Network.